Welcome to part two of Neo-Paganism and the Arts, Why Should We Care? We're going to continue now with illustrations from music. And for music, I picked three people in particular, three icons of the music world who have been around for decades, had tremendous careers, and are impacting and inspiring younger generations. The first one I want to look at is Sting. Started off with the Police, and then a solo career. Now, Sting grew up in the church, and if you listen to his music much, this is evident. But later on in life, left any belief within the church to pursue paganism. And it's interesting, before his CD, The Soul Cages, both his parents had died, and he chose originally to take the modernist route of, let's just toughen up and push through it, let's not take time to mourn. But he found after a couple years his creative juices were absolutely stifled. So in a way to try to stir up and free up his creative juices again, he flew to Brazil to partake in an ancient pagan ritual to deal with the mourning and death of his parents. Now, he even says in his music that he gave up on the Holy Church at this time. The lyrics say, I lost my belief in the Holy Church, and then go on to say, but if I ever lose my faith in you, and the you there is his wife, or wife-to-be, he's replaced his belief in church with his belief in his wife and his marital relationship. Now, it's interesting because I've heard this song on Christian radio stations where Christian artists are singing this song. And, of course, I assume, to give them the benefit of the doubt, they're singing it as if he's saying, I've given up on the church. Organized religion is not the answer, but my faith is in you because it's really about a personal relationship with Christ. The problem is, a healthy Christianity never shows disdain for the church. The church is God's means of grace to minister to us, and the way he ministers through that corporate body for us to share each other's burdens. So it's not something we are to disdain in the first part. But secondly, it also we need to be careful that when he's saying, if I ever lose my faith in you, I'll be in trouble, that he's speaking to a woman, and now we're speaking to Christ. But the transference of that concept is not necessarily so clean. So I caution there if people would understand what he's really saying and that they're copying and selling and playing on Christian radio stations. But nonetheless, this is an example of where he's gone. He goes later in a CD, Sacred Love. He's singing to his wife, and it gets more explicit. He says, you're my religion, you're my church. You're the holy grail at the end of my search, this sacred love. And he's talking about his relationship with his wife. And he's known notably for being involved in tantric sex and finding spiritual ecstasy in that arena, which is coming out of the Buddhist tradition. And it's an elevation of sex, the joy and the extreme pleasure found in sexual union, which is supposed to be, in a biblical sense, you look at the Song of Songs, it is a foretaste of heaven. It's a glorious picture of our union with Christ. It's supposed to give us a picture of what it's like to be fully united with God, to be fully vulnerable with our defenses down, to be fully naked emotionally, spiritually, all those senses before him, and to connect with him and him to love us in that moment. And sex is to be a picture of that, not to be worshipped just because it's wonderful. It is wonderful, but it is not the end. It is a foretaste and a picture of what is to come. So that is another picture where the paganism takes something that's part of creation and worships it rather than seeing it as pointing to the Creator himself. Now, the third artist I'm going to look at, who's done a lot of collaboration with younger artists lately, is Santana. 1972, Santana became a huge fan of the pioneering fusion band Mahavishnu Orchestra and its guitarist, John McLaughlin. Now, McLaughlin introduced Santana's wife to his guru, who accepted them as disciples, and they got very involved and gave him a Buddhist name, Devadip. And if you look at the titles of Santana's work, Shaman, Sacred Fire, Moonflower, Supernatural, you quickly see the pagan influence within his lyrics, within his titles, and his lifestyle. Now, he's having a lot of impact with young artists today. He's collaborating with Wycliffe and with Fuji's Lauryn Hill, with Rob Thomas, with Dave Matthews. And he's passing on these ideas because they all looked up to him because he is a phenomenal artist. God gave him tremendous talents. It's merely a shame that he's not using them to glorify his creator. And the last artist we're going to look at in music field is Madonna. And Madonna, of course, originally we might think of as materialistic because she was the material girl, or later her songs like A Virgin, exploring her sexuality, very much embracing that and pushing the boundaries all the time. And at times she's been very vocal against the church. But she's gone all the way around to now she's embraced the Kabbalah, which is a mystic strain of Judaism, a heretical view within the Judaistic tradition. And the picture I have in my PowerPoint here is that she's greeting Shimon Peres in Israel, saying, "I'm an ambassador for Israel." Now, we don't know what Israel thinks of Madonna, but she wants to be an ambassador, is very much into the Kabbalah, this pantheistic understanding of the Torah. And she's impacting a lot of the young women coming up through the scenes, as you see at the VH1 Awards, the MTV Awards. She is one they look up to and they want to get advice from or emulate. She has tremendous power in who she influences. So that's some illustrations from music and the pantheistic or pagan worldview there. I want to move on to literature. Now, in literature, a couple of the first books are also films, so they're a crossover. I don't want to spend too much time on them, but the first one was The Da Vinci Code. It explored the pagan notion of the Holy Grail actually being a woman's body, and specifically Mary's womb. And so salvation came through a woman's body, not through Christ. And a radical departure from the gospel. Now, websites and books have been dedicated to exploring the heresies and exposing them, and I'm not going to go into that here. But it fits the pagan worldview, it fits American culture, because what do we like to know more about than anything in the tabloids is the sex life of some celebrity. And who's the biggest celebrity of all time is Christ. So no wonder this was a big seller. It should not have been a surprise to us. But it takes us into a pagan worldview, not seeing the creator outside of creation, but the salvation is through this womb and this mystic, mysterious connection with a creature, this woman in particular. Now, another movie that's more recent is Golden Compass. Again, we mentioned Philip Pullman's books and how he hated C.S. Lewis. And in his movie, he's attacking the magisterium, which is a picture some equivocate with the Roman Catholic Church. Clearly, emulates more of a Nietzschean will to power religious institution. And the filmmaker tried to water it down by making of it more of a social institution and political than religious than the books. And to be fair, Christians don't believe that the Bible describes a church that is authoritarian. We would disagree with that as well. But the answer is not to reject the church altogether. The answer is to say it's in spirit and in truth following Christ in a relationship, not through authoritarian rule and ritual. But nonetheless, the Golden Compass is not as large nearly as Da Vinci Code or any of these others, but it has done well. The investment on this film was $180 million. Only it's made $60 million domestically thus far, and over $100 million internationally. So it's making its money back. It probably, I would assume, produce the next one. So we have The Da Vinci Code, Golden Compass. The third book I want to look at is not a novel, but it's a self-help book called The Secret. And it's one of many self-help books whose sales have been boosted tremendously once they've been on Oprah. This book, I believe, was selling 10,000 copies a week before Oprah, and after the author was on Oprah, it boosted up to 100,000 a week and has been on the top-selling charts since then. And though many Christians watch Oprah and assume she's teaching something consistent with Scripture, this unfortunately just isn't true. She has pearls of wisdom here and there. I don't want to say everything Oprah says is untrue. There are things she says is true, but she's not founding it on Scripture or a biblical worldview. Listen to some of the quotes from The Secret. Quote, "Everything that's coming into your life, you are attracting into your life," Byrne writes. "You are the most powerful magnet in the universe. So as you think a thought, you are also attracting like thoughts to you," end quote. And the assumption here is that your personal desires govern your future. If we stop and think that our desires govern our future, this is in direct contrast to the Bible. Who is the architect and finisher of our faith but God? Who created everything? Who is the Alpha and Omega? God. Who is sovereign and controls everything? God. This is in direct opposition, saying our desires are what controls our future instead of God is what controls our future. Now, to be fair, in the Bible, God can work through us, and we can be working with God in certain components. Some of the reformers call this a secondary means that he works through us. Rather than work directly through miracles, he works through us to feed the poor and to seek justice and to seek the good of the city. But our desires are not driving the future. God is driving the future. Now, of course, they quote the Bible, because all religions seem to quote the Bible to persuade Christians that it's legitimate. Matthew 21:22, they quote, where it says, "Whatsoever ye shall ask in prayer, believing, ye shall receive." And the law of attraction is based on this. Now, of course, this is a bastardized version of this verse. The verse is talking about if you're following Christ, and if you're loving the Father, and if you pray His will, God will give you what you ask for, if you are seeking Him with all your heart. He doesn't say, seek what you want with your heart, and I'll give it to you like I'm some vending machine. But the law of attraction in the book says this. There are three steps. First, know what you want and ask the universe for it. Second, feel and behave as if the object of your desire is on its way. And third, be open to receiving it. There are aspects of this law that are clearly attractive to the human heart. Who doesn't want to think they're in ultimate control over their lives so that you can have anything you want just by desiring it? We would all like to control our destinies and to feel that the universe is at our beck and call, that it's a friendly force working with us and not against us. As book reviewer Tim Challies succinctly points out, there's a problematic component. If you follow this through logically, it implies that Jews brought the Holocaust on themselves. Equally as tragic, it implies that a sexually abused child invited the abuse. These are horrific problems you cannot discard. And what happens when two people desire the same thing? The secret tells us that to sacrifice shows your belief in lack. You should instead always look out for yourself. Well, if to sacrifice shows a belief in lack, then they are saying that Christ, when he came to sacrifice to die on the cross, was failing to be all that he could be. That his choice to become human or to die on the cross were all horrible choices for him. He should have pursued selfish desires. Which are horrific statements. But it shows where selfishness takes us. If we're always selfish, we're not loving others. We're not loving our neighbors or ourselves. We're just loving ourselves. But if we're asking for just to fulfill the desires of our heart, the dangerous part is our heart is not pure. We're selfish. As Jeremiah tells us, the heart is deceitful and wicked above all things. Who can search it out? We need to be careful. Selfishness does not fix the world just by everyone getting what they want. But you see, the author is really ascribing divinity to humanity. Listen to this, quote, "The earth turns on its orbit for you. The ocean ebbs and flows for you. The birds sing for you. The sun rises and it sets for you. The stars come out for you. Every beautiful thing you see, every wondrous thing you experience is all there for you. Take a look around. None of it can exist without you. No matter who you thought you were, now you know the truth of who you really are. You are the master of the universe. You are the heir to the kingdom. You are the perfection of life, and now you know the secret." And if you heard, those are a lot of loaded terms. Heir to the kingdom is clearly from biblical context. The master of the universe. Or the crazy, crazy claim, "None of it can exist without you." Really? Really? I think if I die, the world will go on just fine. My wife will mourn, my children will mourn, other friends will mourn. It will not stop the earth on its axis. The earth does not exist for me. I'm not that delusional or narcissistic. The secret makes the same mistake all pagan ideologies make. They note the dignity of humanity, but instead of saying that's because we're made in the image of God, and that we're fearfully and wonderfully made, they stop there and start worshiping us. They worship our desires, our abilities. Now, this naive self-help idea fails as a life philosophy because it only portrays and describes positive wishes. What about the man who wishes his boss was dead? Or a jealous lover becomes enraged and beats up their lover? See, the problem is that the desires of our heart are not always things that are good for society or even good for us. As the old Chinese curse was said to say, "May you get what you wish for." We shouldn't always get what we want. We don't always know what would be best for us. And there's no hope for people with bad thoughts. or bad consequences. There's no redemption or forgiveness. Only mental gymnastics to run away from those complexities. Now, it is easy to see that paganism is alive and well in American culture. We've seen it in the films, the books, the music. And the question is, how do we respond? Well, first we have to understand the core differences. And you've heard much of this, but let me boil this down as succinctly as possible. Within the Christian worldview, there's a creator-creature distinction. God is sovereign. He created the world. He still loves us and works through us and governs and protects us. But in the pagan worldview, it is simply evolution. It's Mother Earth. It's this ebb and flow. There's nothing outside of creation to give us hope. Now, there's an antithesis in the Christian worldview, that there is a need for order and distinction and clarification. There is a purpose of roles and hierarchy to bring order. Another part of the antithesis is evil versus good, that God is good and just. And something to be good is to be pure. Evil is a perversion of the good. Someone who is very bright, who uses that ability in an evil way, is perverting their intelligence. Someone who is persuasive can pervert it to be manipulative. Or someone who is attractive can use it to pervert it to become seductive. But those are good things. It is not bad to be beautiful or bad to be intelligent or bad to be bright or wonderful or persuasive. Those are good things. Evil is merely a parasitic component that perverts the good. But if you go to the pagan worldview, they don't see it that way. They would say the yin and yang are parts of a whole. They're just this ebb and flow. And there's a universal egalitarianism. Everyone is equal. Everything is equal. Like Del Toro in Pan's Labyrinth, it's all the same. There are no distinctions. And therefore, they don't hold up systems of leadership or government or order. The problem is it leads to anarchy and ignores the sin nature. If we were all basically good, this might work. But we're not. And education, as they say, is not the answer. See, the pagan world would say our problem is we don't have the right perception or the right thinking, and we need to have a higher consciousness and kind of this aha moment. But the problem is education has never been the answer. We've had 100 years in this country of all kinds of education that doesn't fix people or fix society. But in the Christian worldview, the problem, the human problem, is that we're separated from God by sin. And the only solution for that is redemption and salvation through Jesus Christ on the cross. Well, those are some basic distinctions between the two worldviews. Now I'd like to look at the artwork created from a biblical worldview versus a pagan worldview. And these are just some simple things for artists who are creating artwork, whether you're working on a team in a film or a media or dance or paintings. The biblical worldview is going to show that your art has a theistic context. There is a God. Maybe particular works of art won't speak to this. But in as much as it does, there is a creator. And there is a sovereign God. We're not here alone by ourselves in a determinist world without hope. The biblical worldview art will also have absolutes. Because we believe in justice. We believe in truth. We believe there is evil. We believe there is goodness. And we believe that the cry for justice is appropriate, and it is the cry of God's heart to bring justice. That is a picture from the Bible. That he is patient, but he longs to bring justice. He hates evil. He wants to restore. And so we can hold on to those absolutes and say, yes, these things are wrong. And yes, it is good to love others. And yes, what Hitler did was evil. You see, the problem with the neo-pagan worldview is that they're evolutionary in their context rather than theistic. And they have a subjective relativism. And you run into this talking to people. They have a moral and cultural relativity that handicaps them from calling anything evil. I've had conversations with young men and women in the industry. They say everything's relative. And you say, well, what about what Hitler did in Germany? Wasn't that evil? And they actually pause and don't know what to say. And the reason they don't know what to say is they're so committed to relativism, and they realize that to say it's evil would conflict with their commitment to relativism. And if you push them more and more, maybe once in a while someone will admit it was evil. But I've had people even go so far as being committed to the worldview that they say maybe he thought it was right. Well, maybe he thought it was right, but it's still evil what he did. And the worldview fails to be honest about reality as they adhere so tightly to subjective relativism or moral and cultural relativity. Now, the other thing about artwork from a Christian worldview versus a pagan worldview, in the Christian worldview, the inherent challenge of the character is going to be that they are estranged from God and men or women because of sin. Sin in the world is what has caused this problem. And the solution is forgiveness. Now, art from a Christian worldview may be a tragedy because it shows the consequences of sin, like the Greek tragedies, that there are consequences. Or it may be like Les Miserables, where there is forgiveness. Both of those are biblical worldview because they show the consequences of sin. It is not all relative. There is either judgment or there is forgiveness. On the other side, the pagan worldview of art will have character challenges, but they're just an inability to adapt because of poor perception. The real goal of the character is some aha moment where they get a higher level of consciousness and aware of their oneness. Those are just some simple categories to look at as we look at art to see whether this is consistent with a biblical worldview or a pagan worldview. Now, for the last part of this podcast, I just want to look at responses and how do we respond to the neo-pagan friend or the neo-pagan artwork. And there are two responses that are kind of the default responses. We'll look at those and then the biblical response. The first one is a Christianity that's undiscerning and lacks discernment, and it's passive, and therefore it's more like the frog in the kettle. We're not aware of what's going on. We become compromised. We want to be liked or achieve success so dearly that we fail to have appropriate boundaries in our work as artists, exploring or taking part in roles and projects we ought not to be a part of. And this leads to syncretism. Now, on the other hand, you have Christians very much committed to orthodoxy and to truth, and they become very religious. They may be very legalistic in their approach. And they critique culture, and they tell us what's wrong with neo-paganism, but it's from a self-righteous point of view. And it becomes Bible-bashing, or boycotting, or attacking, and they never engage culture. They never engage the artist and love them and show them Christ. They simply stand at a distance and throw rocks. If they're artists, oftentimes they have excessive rules about what they can or can't be involved in, which limits them tremendously, and they fail to be salt and light because they almost never even work with someone who's not a Christian. And the religious commitment, sometimes religious self-righteousness, leads to a fight-or-flight mentality because it doesn't see the neo-pagan person as someone God loved. They're simply committed to their own spiritual journey. So those are the two, the passive or the overly religious. And now we just want to offer the third view, which is the biblical response. And this third approach is what an actual biblical response looks like. It's much like the life of Daniel working for pagan kings in a pagan culture. As you recall, Daniel worked for four kings and three kingdoms. All of them were pagan. But he's always respectful to the king. He didn't say, I can't work in a pagan culture. God placed him there. He said, I can study your religions and your mythology and your astrology, all these things, but I won't eat food sacrificed to idols, and I won't bow to your gods. So he has boundaries, he has restrictions on what he will do and won't do, but yet he's very involved in their world, in being salt and light, and bringing justice, and building the infrastructure of that world. You see, in that approach, we can stand fast in our faith while working in environments we may find challenging. We don't adopt the views of the pagans, but we can work with them in a way that we're salt and light. This gives us appropriate restrictions and freedom. And it gives us a boldness while being gracious. We're bold because we know we're loved by God and He is sovereign. He will protect us and guide us. And yet we're gracious because we know we're forgiven. And we long to express that grace and that forgiveness to others who are in the industry or in our particular vocation. And so the challenge for us is we see the rise in paganism throughout our culture as we leave a Christian culture and become post-Christian. This paganism comes in, is a challenge for the church and Christian to go back and really know the Bible, to know that God is sovereign, we're not alone, to approach this with discernment and live as ambassadors for Christ. Not to be foolish, but to be wise so that we might win some, that we might be salt and light within this world.